time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have back with us live in the studios this morning, Jerome Gold. Jerome Gold is co-founder and publisher of Black Heron Press and the author of 15 books, including Sergeant Dickinson, a novel based in part on his experience in the Vietnam War, The Moral Life of Soldiers, Life at the End of Time, Paranoia and Heartbreak, 15 Years in a Juvenile Facility, which we had the chance to interview him about here in the studios back in 2009. And he is here to talk about his new book, In the Spider's Web, a nonfiction novel. Jerome, thank you very much for coming back and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
So start out, tell us a little bit about Black Heron Press.
Well, we started, I had a partner when we started back in 1984. And actually, we started the press to publish a short novel that he had written. He hadn't been able to get it published. It had been almost published a number of times. The last time the publisher bumped it for a novel by Joyce Carol Oates. So Les never read anything by Joyce Carol Oates again. but I had gone. I'd gone to the South Pacific for a year, and when while I was there, I met a man who was an editor, one of the editors of a small press based in Pongo Pongo and Milwaukee. And I just milked him for everything I could get out of him about small press. I'd never heard of small presses before. And as it turned out, everything he told me was not true. But I didn't know that, so in all ignorance, I was able to get started. And I talked with Les, the author of The 40 Fathom Bank, the novel I mentioned earlier. And he was reluctant to form his own press. He didn't want to do the work. And also, there was an aspect of feeling that it was a vanity press to form it to publish his book. But my argument was, how will you feel in 5 years if you don't do it now and it's never published? And that was a convincing argument. And it's still a question I ask myself when I'm debating whether or not to publish a book. We do a lot of other books now, too. How will I feel in 5 years if I pass up this book? And if I think I'll feel okay, then I won't publish it. If I think that I'll regret it, then I will publish it. So that was the beginning of Black Heron Press, and I learned so much from publishing his book that I had a book also, which a number of writers liked that I'd passed it around to. But it was on the Vietnam War, and in those days you couldn't get anything published that dealt with Vietnam. So we went ahead and published it, and those gatekeepers who had kept it from being published with other presses, I found that they were gatekeepers, but there was an audience for Vietnam materials if you just get past them. And we got a glowing review from Library Journal, and that one review in itself sold 1,000 copies to libraries. And then that, so we did that through Black Heron Press, and some years later we sold it to Soho Press, and they retitled it under the name of Sergeant Dickinson. And they sold a few thousand more copies. And then after 11 or 12 years, they let it go out of print, and I snatched it back, and now it's out from Black Heron again. But we've published 80 or 100 books now over, 30 years, including a number of award winners or near award winners. We have some writers are world class in that we get them translated into foreign languages. And they're published in other countries. I don't know where else to go with this.
Okay. Well, one of your latest publications is your new book, In the Spider's Web, a nonfiction novel. What was the motivation in writing that book?
As with most of the books I've done lately, most of the books I've written lately, I want people that... Not that I consider them exceptional necessarily, but I consider them worthy to be remembered. I want a way of remembering them, not only for myself. I want the public, the reading public, to know that these people existed. None of us live forever. And some people, because of the lives they've led, should not be forgotten. So this girl, I knew her when she was a girl, Caitlin Weber. This is a false name, but that's the name we'll use. I've known her since she was 14 years old, and her life has been one of such struggle that I think I don't want it to just fall by. I don't want memories of her life to fall by the wayside. So this is a record of at least part of it, at least insofar as I've had firsthand knowledge. So that was my motivation in writing about her. The first part of the book, of course, is setting the scene, is showing the environment she's about to step into. So,
which is in a juvenile prison facility here in Washington State.
Yeah, it's a prison.
For 15 years.
Yeah, I was there. It's a prison as distinct from a jail. A jail is really kind of a metropolitan. It's like detention for juveniles or where you go to spend a night, or even up to a year if you're an adult. But a prison, you're a convicted felon. So it's a state prison here in Washington State. We have several. We have, for juveniles, we have two now. We used to have up to six. When I was in the system, there were at one point there were as many as six, and they were all overpopulated. This is back in the 80s and 90s, back during when a lot of kids were getting sent to prison for drugs. And before a study came out showing that in some cases, kids do better if they don't go to prison. They don't get into the parole system, if they just be monitored, even if they've been convicted of felonies. I don't know how they would identify those cases, but statistically, there was a study that showed that. And after that study, fewer kids, in Washington State at least, went to prison. But when I first started in the system, units that were designed to hold 16 kids were holding up to 23, 24. And, it was really tough. It was really violent then. A lot of gang kids from different gangs. By the time I left the system, a lot of the units were underpopulated, and they were closing up. We called them cottages. They were closing up some of the cottages where I worked at the place I call Ash Meadow.
So talk more about Caitlin and what landed her at your facility.
It was a notorious case here in the Northwest. A mom in her she's 37, I think, put together a little coalition of five kids to kill her employer. Her employer was a man who had hired her to care for his mother. Her employer, he was in his mid-60s, had recently retired from his job. His mother was, I think, 88 or 89 at the time, and had Alzheimer's. He himself had cancer. It was terminal. He refused treatment, was self-medicating with alcohol. He had a history of drinking, and he also had a history of abusing women when drunk, although when he was sober, he could be a really nice, generous man. But he was increasingly drinking because he was self-medicating, as I said. So he hired Caitlin's mother to, I think I call her Linda, to care for his mother. And she brought, and so she moved into the basement of his house along with her three children, Caitlin being the oldest. And then she found out that he had sold some property and got some cash for it, put it in his account. And so she, I don't know if she ever admitted to that being her motivation, but the prosecutor said it was, and it made sense that it was. But anyhow, she got together Caitlin and four other kids. Caitlin was only 13 at the time. The youngest kid was 12. The oldest was 17. to kill him. This included Caitlin's best friend, Sonia. And so they did. They at first, Caitlin and Sonia and some other kids, not those who were ultimately involved in the murder, they were going to kill him. They went to his room with knives and baseball bats, as I recall, and were going to go into his room and kill him while he was asleep, and then he couldn't bring themselves to do it. He just could not do it. And sometime later, some months, a month or two later, again, Caitlin, Sonia, and three other kids ambushed him when he came home from work after having been out in the bars. Not, he didn't come home from work, when he came home from the bars. And killed him as soon as he stepped in the door. They began beating him with bats and ultimately stabbed him. There was this one part. The two girls were in the basement with Caitlin's mother and her siblings, and the three boys were up above beating the man. And then the two younger boys, ages 14 and 16, according to their testimony, they suddenly realized they were really killing this guy. And they hadn't intended to do that. They just were. They had agreed to beat him up, but not to kill him. And so they dropped. They were using souvenir bats, like you're giving away at ball games. And so they dropped the bats and just ran away. And that left the oldest boy by himself. And he called for the two girls to come up and help him. Meanwhile, the two girls could hear what was going on up above. And Sonia, instead of going upstairs, Caitlin did go up. Instead of going upstairs, she tried to climb out the basement window. But Linda, Caitlin's mother, called her back saying, "You're not being a very good friend to Caitlin." And I think that's one of the most heartbreaking lines, that out of loyalty, she went back to participate in a murder. And, of course, not only did she help to kill somebody, but it affected the rest of her life, that out of loyalty. I think somewhere in the book I have this line or this paragraph about all these kids, these two girls and other kids I knew at Eschmiddel who were in for murder or other serious crimes, that they're all there out of loyalty, that they had, which we all consider a good virtue, a virtue. The problem was they were loyal to the wrong person, every one of them, and so there they were. So, I don't remember your question, though.
Oh, it was just Caitlin's story. So, she eventually arrives at your facility, and you want to have her on your caseload.
Yeah, I got to know, Sonia came to us first, and I liked Sonia. She already had a counselor. I liked her. She was really smart and personable. She was really frightened at first, but once she got past that, she was very personable. And a couple of years earlier, I had had another girl on my caseload, and she was pretty damaged, emotionally damaged, and I had helped her, and I was given a lot of credit for the work I had done with her. But she was gone now. And I wanted somebody to, I wanted to raise another girl. I have a biological daughter who by that time was grown and living in Germany, so I hardly ever got to see her. And I probably missed her more than I realized at the time, because my boss commented to me once about knowing how much Caitlin had invested herself in me, but also that I had in her. And I said back, "But you know, that's how I get with these kids." And that was true. It was true of boys and girls. But I had this daughter, and she'd been gone for years. So, and Caitlin knew that too, knew that she and perhaps Sonia were substitutes. But it didn't matter. I mean, I still see Caitlin. And actually, I run into Sonia occasionally. I visit Caitlin at the women's prison here in Washington State. And Sonia's still there. I see her occasionally. And I still feel kind of fatherly or grandfatherly toward them. So, lost your question again. I get wrapped up in my memories.
That's okay. So, and we should, if we haven't already, point out that a lot of this work comes from the fact that you kept journals during this entire time that you're there.
Yeah. I actually began that series of journals before I went to work there. I was on active duty for the first Gulf War. I didn't go to the Middle East, but still, I had a staff job in Army Reserve Command, and I started a journal just to help me think about problems we were encountering, help me think them through. And then I got off of active duty and went to work out at Ash Meadow, and I just kept doing it, kept keeping that journal. And the purpose of it, again, was to help me think through what I was encountering, but also to relieve emotional stress. That and exercise. I was a runner. I still am. I think got me through. I think I probably would have gotten pretty sick without it. I don't know how people who don't exercise or don't have some art form or quasi-art form to get them through stressful period of their lives. I don't know how they do it. Maybe they do get sick. So, yeah, I kept a journal all that time. I don't much anymore. I still keep a journal, but I don't write in it too much anymore, or rarely. But so I was there for 15 years, and I probably kept a journal for kept that particular series of journals for maybe 17 years total. Yeah. Earlier in my life, I'd been involved with other things and doing research in this or that, and I kept journals then too. So it wasn't new to me. But it did affect, my first book, Paranoia and Heartbreak, my first book on Ash Meadow, Paranoia and Heartbreak, is entirely from my journal. It's probably three quarters of the journal I kept during that period. And this book, the second part of it, it's in two parts, the second part of it draws heavily on my journal, but also I didn't, in the first book I limited myself to the journal itself. If it wasn't in the journal, it didn't get into the book. But in this one, I approached it more as a memoir, and so I included some memories, both in the first and second parts of this book, of Spider's Web.
It's as amazing as does your previous book on this particular issue. It has these amazing insights into both the kids that you're working with as well as yourself. A lot of personal insights that I found quite wrenching to read and to ponder on. So I want to make sure we touch on, since we only have about 10 minutes left, if you talk about the effects on the kids of going through, basically going to prison and through these facilities we have here in Washington State and what that does to them.
Right. As far as Washington State, the facilities in Washington State are concerned, these are considered pretty good. More than pretty good, very good. But then you're comparing them to places like New York State. When I worked out at Ash Meadow, I was given a study that the superintendent wanted me to look at. Actually, it was a proposal for a study that a research team in New York, they wanted to come out to Washington to study our institution, Ash Meadow, and compare it to New York State because they were concerned about violence in the juvenile prisons in New York. And the violence they were concerned with was staff against residents, or staff against inmates. We call them residents. I read it, and I couldn't believe there was that much going on. I mean, it was almost daily. And I said, there's nothing to compare. We're so unlike them, it would be fruitless to even have them come out. Occasionally we have something like this. There was one incident that I knew of that happened years before where a staff beat up a resident. And then after I was shown that proposal, it happened again. So say in 15 years, there were two incidents, not to downplay either one, but in New York, this happened often. They considered it normal. So Washington is, by comparison with New York or Illinois or a number of other places, is considered pretty good, as dysfunctional as it may be. Kids who spent a long time in prison, long time meaning, say, 3 years or more, 2 or 3 years or more, they spent time in prison as kids, they miss out on experiencing those socializing mechanisms that kids outside of prison do experience. So girls, for example, don't know how to evaluate boys. Boys don't know how to evaluate girls. But by evaluate, I mean how to judge what it is that they're really asking or really saying, because so much of our communication is done below the surface. And kids on the outside, you just grow up into that bit by bit. Kids on the inside, they don't experience that. When they get out, and there's a number of other things they don't experience. When they get out, just taking a bus, if they haven't had to do that before, or say they want to go to a job interview and they don't have a car, so they're relying on the bus, and they don't realize that the bus may not show, so they need a backup plan. And so they miss the job interview, they miss the job. That's really frustrating, and it's also financially difficult for them, because a parole officer tends to be pretty, I don't want to say heartless, but unforgiving. He set up the interview, they don't make the interview, and he's angry now. A couple of the girls I dealt with in prison and who got out, more than a couple actually, but who I was able to get information on later, and some... they got pregnant quick. They couldn't tell when they were being conned. One girl had most of her belongings stolen by a guy who preyed on women just coming out of prison. He got her computer, got a lot of other stuff too. And I found out about him because a former inmate called when I was still working at Ashmiddle and told me about it and said he had done the same thing to her. And she had gone and stolen back her computer. She'd burglarized his house and got it back and got on it and realized that there was a list of names, and she was calling all those names, warning them about this guy. So I'm concerned about Caitlin. I still see Caitlin. I still visit her about once a month. And she has a few more years to go. She'll be in her 30s when she gets out. She's been locked up since she was 13. And she has no experience with, no practical experience with the world outside prison. She thinks she does because she watches movies and she reads books and she gets what she can from that. But there's no substitute for personal experience and learning how to deal with all the frustration that comes with learning something that you think you should already know. So I think there is a solution to this, and they need some, especially for kids, they need transition periods. I don't think we have many group homes left anymore, if any. But aside from the group homes, courses can be taught. When I was at Ashmeta, we did have some courses like that, teaching kids what to expect and how to deal with it. But then the institution adopted a therapy called dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, developed here at the University of Washington. But it adopted it in a huge way, sort of did away with everything else. And so these kinds of classes went by the wayside. And then DBT was sold to us. The guy who was selling it said it reduced recidivism by 57%, and it just wasn't true. when the research was done, it didn't reduce recidivism at all. So we got conned too. But he made a career for himself within the system. That aside, if those kinds of classes can be brought back, there would be teachers willing to teach it. I'm sure there would even be volunteers willing to help. Ashmel relied to some extent on volunteers, teaching courses, actual school courses that the school itself didn't offer, like physics or advanced math. Some kids are gifted, you know, but they're in prison. And that particular school, the school there on campus, just didn't offer what many kids needed. It was geared down to special ed. And we did have a lot of special ed kids. We had, at any one time, we had 40 to 45% kids who had mental health problems, enough so that they had to be medicated. The kids had to be medicated, which is comparable to the adult prisons, where I think it may even be higher. But in the adult prisons, they don't get the medication. I know just a little bit about adult prisons from having visited Caitlin, and also I went to Monroe once on a tour. Actually to speak to the Lifers Club there about writing and publishing and listening to some of their stories. But mostly I know about the kid system, the child system. So where do we go from there?
So, and we just have 2 minutes left. Caitlin's case... Do you believe that, I mean, she really should have even been in that facility?
Yeah, I think so. I think actually it was probably good for her up to a point. And, of course, society demands retribution in society in the guise of a prosecutor. And attorneys and police officers I've spoken with about her case just in conversation, all of them are astounded that she got a 22-year sentence when she was 13 years old. She had never been in trouble with police before, and neither had Sonia. Sonia appeared before the clemency board, and you could see from their reaction to her story that they were a little surprised, too, that she was even sentenced as an adult. Caitlin said that she thought she should have gotten maybe 10 or 12 years. But at 13, that would place her into the realm of adulthood. And our system in Washington State does not allow that. If she's going to be tried as an adult, the minimum she could get was 20 or 22 years, which is what she got. If she's going to be tried as a juvenile, she'd get out earlier than the judge wanted her to get out. The judge became convinced by a representative of Ash Meadow that Caitlin could refuse rehabilitation treatment. The guy lied. The administrator lied. She could not refuse. I was the one who gave her most of that treatment, and she didn't have a choice. She didn't want to take it at first. Turned out she enjoyed it, but at first she didn't want to take it. But she did have a choice. She could spend that time in her room when all the other kids were out at recreation or in school. So she did take those courses. And one of them, aggression replacement training, which I taught, does reduce recidivism. The research shows it does reduce recidivism here in Washington State by 24%, looking at its graduates over a year and a half. So, but we lost that.
They canceled that, didn't they?
Yeah.
Or they replaced it with something else that was ineffective.
Right.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, a half hour flies by way too quickly. And so we're gonna have to drag you back in to talk about this some more, because this clearly wasn't enough time. I want to thank you for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you, Mike, for having me.